from Iraq, saying if the Iraqi government agrees to this treaty, that it would be a black page in the chapter of Iraqi history.
That's NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. General Motors reportedly plans another round of cost-cutting measures at up to 10 factories as it teeters on the brink of collapse. The Associated Press cites local union officials saying that workers were told this morning about production cuts and extended holiday shutdowns. Drivers nationwide are now paying on average just under $2 for a gallon of regular gas. The Auto Club AAA says prices fell more than 1% overnight. Oil prices are still hovering at a three-year low of about $50 a barrel. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
WILL programs are made possible in part by the Jane Addams Bookshop on North Neal Street in downtown Champaign. Jane Addams Bookshop is a full-service antiquarian bookstore, buying and selling used and rare books, open 7 days a week.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider, with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us listening this morning. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frank is at the controls this morning. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we're pleased to have with us a man who is an award-winning writer-photographer. His name is Tim Palmer. He has authored 19 books dealing with rivers and conservation and the environment. He's an accomplished photographer, has one of the most complete collections of photos of rivers in the United States. He's been doing this kind of work for a long time. He has a bachelor's degree in landscape architecture from Penn State. He worked 8 years as a land use planner on land use and environmental topics, and then started to write full-time in 1980. He's written a lot and has done a lot of work in the area of river conservation. He does a lot of public speaking, traveling around the country, talking about what he has seen about the issues of water quality, showing his photographs. He has canoed or rafted on more than 300 rivers in the United States and Western Canada, and in addition, doing a lot of traveling around the country. He's won a number of awards for his work. For example, his book, The Heart of America, Our Landscape, Our Future, was awarded Best Book of the Year in the Essay and Travel category by the Independent Publishers Association. He won in 2005 the Benjamin Franklin Award for the Best American Book on Nature and the Environment for his book, California Wild. He was the first recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from American Rivers in 1988 for his conservation and creative river work. And he is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. He is going to be the featured speaker for the 11th annual dinner of the Prairie Rivers Network, and that's taking place tonight. And otherwise, if you're interested in seeing some of his work, I might suggest you, it's heavy. you look at one of his recent books. The title is Rivers of America. Abrams is the publisher, and it is full of many really just beautiful, stunning photographs. So head down to the bookstore and look for the book. And if you'd like to call in here, talk with our guest this morning, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm just really stunned by this figure that you have been on 300 rivers.
Oh, that was the fun part.
When would that have started? What was the earliest?
I guess it started at about age 18 or so. You know, the river relationship started way before that, though.
That's something that's obviously important to it, has been for a long time.
It has. I grew up in the Appalachian foothills in Pennsylvania, and there was a spring on our property and where we would get water to water our garden from. And I was fascinated by this spring and started to follow the route that its water took downstream. And as I grew older, I followed that stream further and further, and I've ended up here today.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you obviously that you became interested in doing work kind of in this area when you went to Penn State and you were doing landscape architecture, and then you did do planning professionally for a while. What was that, just somehow not satisfying, or was there something else you thought, well, there's something else I want to do here?
Well, no, it was a wonderful career. I mean, landscape architecture is a wonderful discipline, this task of combining art and the environment. And planning was as well, looking at the big questions of the future of our landscape and our communities. But as a part of the planning job, for one thing, I was always involved with rivers, and water was always close to my heart. But on the planning job, I wrote planning reports of many different kinds. Eventually, I realized nobody reads that stuff. And so I became interested in writing in a more personal vein. And speaking to people a little more directly about what the problems affecting their landscapes and their communities. And by that time, I was writing the work program of what we do for the next 5 years at the County Planning Agency. So I wrote in some softer approach reports about what was happening to our landscape and why and how people should become involved in its future. And I found that really rewarding. So at the same time, I was paddling down rivers wherever I could, and I began to justify my otherwise pointless existence paddling by writing stories about it, magazine stories. And eventually, I got a book idea and sold the first book idea and then the second book idea. And at that point, I retired from the planning job in 1980. And I've been writing about rivers and environmental issues and photographing landscapes ever since.
And traveling and continuing to paddle.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about your interest in rivers, because as you have said, there is a particularly strong interest there. And certainly, if you look at some of the photographs that you've taken, they're all really beautiful places. It's not really surprising that would catch your interest. But is there something about the idea, perhaps it's the idea that it's moving, that it's not stationary?
That's definitely, there are a lot of things about it, David. That's definitely one of the big ones. But the rivers are our lifelines, very simply. And we need our rivers. We can't live without them. Each of us is 70% water. And every drop of that water comes from a river, or from groundwater, which is intimately tied to the surface flow. And so this fascination that I feel for flowing water, and that many people feel, is really no mystery. The rivers literally flow in our arteries and in our veins. So that's one thing. They're the most important places for wildlife. The riparian riverfront corridors are the most important places for birds, for mammals, for the remaining natural ecosystems that we have. And this is especially important in the Midwest, where the landscape has been so heavily converted, 95, up to 99% of it in our Midwestern states converted to agriculture and urbanization. Those thin corridors of green along the rivers are really all that's left of the natural environment. So we've got to take care of that, and we've got to actually improve on that again by restoring some of what's left. So that's another thing. The rivers, I think, are very symbolic of life as well. You know, there are hundreds of novels that have the word river in them. They're nothing about flowing water. It's this idea that the river signifies life. And I think that's a very powerful symbol in today's world.
Yeah. And I think, too, you know, you have to, and I'm sure that it's something that you have thought about and written about. Now that we use the internal combustion engine to get around, we don't appreciate it. But you think about the role that rivers have played in the earlier history in America. They were the superhighways. That's why it is people lived along them. And the big cities were on major rivers. They were extremely important in the development of the country.
That's right. And like so much of our history, this is a two-edged sword. You know, the rivers were the arteries and the centerpiece, and for that reason people were aware of them and had a personal relationship with rivers, which is a good thing. But of course, in the process of commercialization and industrialization and settlement, even before that, the rivers were looked at as simply a conduit for commerce, and then as a water supply for our industries, and then as a waistline for our towns. And so what we need to do today is grapple with this very mixed heritage of attitudes about our waterways and, of course, about our environment in general, and recognize that these rivers are centerpiece to our civilization, but also recognize that they have not been treated well and that any civilization worthy of the term has to do a better job of taking care of the source of its own life.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Tim Palmer. He is a writer and photographer, has written a lot about nature and the environment, and as we have discussed here, he's particularly interested in rivers. And one of the things that you might do is see if you can find a copy of his book, Rivers of America. It's just I've been out now for about 2 years, maybe?
Two years. Mm-hmm.
And it has just a lot of really stunningly beautiful photographs.
Thank you, David. And if you like that, there's a new volume that is much like this book about trees and forests.
Oh, excellent.
My publisher wanted to do another volume on the great landscapes of America. And so same format, gorgeous big format photo book of art quality photos about trees and forests came out.
We can talk about that a little bit, and maybe at some point we'll just talk. If people are interested in talking about nature photography and they had a question, I'm sure that we can do that too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here. We have someone to start us off in Villa Grove, and this would be line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm going to be backtracking a little bit.
Yes.
I wanted to ask about whenever you first started, how did it all affect from going from one job into this other field that, you know, can be kind of unstable? How did that affect your family life and that kind of thing? Are you married and how did that affect you and your wife? Was she supportive on that?
I love these kind of questions. A lot of people are afraid to ask, but thank you. I am married. I was not at the time when I made the career switch. I am now. My wife is a writer also. And I actually lived out of my van for 22 years, traveling the country and staying in the places that I was writing about and doing the research and work I needed in that way. And then when I met Anne, she turned out was a writer also, and so we did this type of work together for quite a few. We did that routine together for 11 years. We only recently, 5 years ago, bought a house on the coast of southern Oregon, where we now live. I'm there a little more than half the time. I'm still on the road about half the time. Anne is with me about half of that time, and that's how we work all of that out. And we have no children. It would have been very difficult for me to pursue this career as I have if I had had children, frankly. I could not have done it because it meant taking that big leap a long time ago with very uncertain and very low income and, it just wouldn't have worked.
That's what I want to find out. That was my main question.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk here with somebody else. And the next caller is in Champaign and line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Since you're a photographer, I think you'd appreciate this. I'm going to tell you about a visual experience I had with rivers that I've never really gotten quite over. I was flying one time, and it was reaching toward dusk, and the sun was positioned just right in the sky. So you couldn't really make out the rivers. You could, but it was getting rather dark. But the sun, as the plane moved, the sun would pick up the headwater of a river, and as the plane moved forward, that light would shoot up fill all the tributaries of the river with light. And it was the most amazing visual experience I've ever had. And I have a feeling that the conditions had to be just right. But as the plane went over, you could watch these rivers below catch the sun, and the reflection of the sun would shoot up and light up all the tributaries. It was just like a beautiful fern. Have you ever experienced this at all?
I have seen that, and it's a wonderful thing. And what a terrific way to highlight the river system of the scene, because all at once there in just one sudden view, the rivers are highlighted in a way that really makes them stand out. And, when I write about rivers, I strive to convey that sense of awareness of river systems and how important they are and how they are, in fact, the highlights of the land. And what you saw and a few other people have seen from the air here is a sunlit phenomenon that just kind of captures that all in one, instant.
Marvelous.
I love
it. I regretted I didn't have a camera or something.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I have some aerial photos in the book because those kind of scenes just, they say so much. And
Do you have some photographs of that phenomenon?
Yes, one of the upper Colorado River. But just aerial photos in general, you know, the people who schedule my airline tickets have to have patience with me because I ask for a window seat and then I ask for a seat ahead of the wing so I don't have wing or engine distortion. And then I ask for a seat on the north side of the plane so I don't have sun glare in the window. And in that way, I get some of these just killer shots from 35,000 feet that you don't get any other way.
Well, I look forward to buying your book.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. There are a lot of really beautiful photographs in the book. One of the things that I was interested in is that you, at least for this book now, I'm not sure what you're doing now, but you shot all this on film. Are you still exclusively shooting film?
David, I still use film, yes.
Wow.
I still do. There are not many of us left, but it serves me well. And my designer at Harry Abrams, big commercial publisher, still prefers film. And the Canon cameras that I use, Fuji Velvia film, are just very hard to beat. The digital cameras are more convenient. They're easier to use. You can do more different things with them easily. But it's just real tough to beat Velvia film for capturing the real qualities of nature and its brilliance. Mm-hmm. The digital cameras are more prone to dust problems, to shock, to water damage. All of those are big issues for me, the way I photograph. I'm running, I'm skiing, I'm boating with my gear constantly. They're heavily battery intensive. I go out for months at a time. Battery recharge would be a problem. Of course, it's fun and great to see your pictures right after you shoot them, but I've done enough that I pretty much know what I've gotten if I bracket the light just a little bit. But, you know, the biggest issue here is if you do Photoshop, which, of course, is the computer program where you can manipulate your pictures after you shoot them, change the light, even change the composition for that matter. If you do Photoshop, it makes total sense to be digital because you just plug into the computer and away you go. I do not do Photoshop. It's part of my reason for photography, a big part, is to simply show nature the way it is. I don't want to change it. Hmm. So virtually everyone else in my field now is just pushing the red button until they get the sunset they want. But I don't do that. So the photos you see that I take are what I saw. They're scenes that you can see. If you go out, if you just don't mind getting up early in the morning or maybe missing a meal or two, you can see the same kind of stuff I saw. It doesn't mean that they're random pictures. You know, I look for the most beautiful scenes I can find with the most gorgeous light that I can find. But I don't change the pictures. And so if I don't do that, one of the big reasons to go digital simply does not exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a point that I wanted to make sure that I make, that for those people who are interested in photography, that in fact you do shoot on film, what you like to do is do as little manipulating of the image as possible, just
That's right.
And you talked about one thing, obviously, that photographers know is that the best time to shoot is either earlier in the morning or late in the afternoon because of the quality of the light.
Virtually everything I take is shot early and late.
Yeah, there are other things I find myself thinking about the fact that I'm sure there are a lot of folks, they go someplace, they're someplace that's just stunningly beautiful and say, oh, this is just fabulous. So they stand there and they take a picture. And then they get home and they get their pictures and they look at it. And it may be because the image has been shrunk, they think, well, that doesn't convey, it's not what I saw. Is there, do you think, some particular trick or tricks, some things that you know about where you stand and how you frame the image, all those sorts of things that makes the difference between a photograph that just, you know, is not very good and something that really conveys the experience of being at that place.
You know, David, one of the fundamental truths of photography is that you never capture life in all its true richness. But we try. And so, you know, I'm disappointed a lot of the time that I just wish that picture I took home with me was half as captivating and luminous and magical as what I really saw. But there are a lot of things we can do, of course. One is looking for the good light. You know, midday, there's too much light. Everything is lit. It becomes too complex. Lower light is warm. It casts long shadows. The colors are richer. You can do that. A big demand of nature photography is to simplify. It's like the arrest of life also, but the nature is simply too complex to just go out and shoot a picture and make it work. You have to look for patterns and to look for a focus to the view. But of course, then no one wants a really simple-minded picture, and so the trick becomes then to add complexity back in up to the limit to where it just begins to look like clutter. So there are a lot of these ways that we look at. But primary rule of good nature photography, though, there are three big rules: be there, and be there. You know, there's nothing that takes the place of being in a place when the light is right, when the conditions are right, and being in, you know, in just the right place to get the photo.
Yeah. We have another caller here. Let's talk with this listener in Belgium, the community not far away from us here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Inge has been sensitive enough not to ask you this question, but I'm going to. I live on a piece of property that has a stream on it, and I work in a piece of property that overlooks a river. And during your travels, what's your most beautiful river?
You know, that's really a tough one. You know, it's kind of like picking your favorite child, that old choice. But so it's really impossible. I tend to think of rivers regionally often. And, you know, I live on the coast of Oregon, and my favorite river is the Elk. I'm sure you've never heard of it.
No, I've been on the Elk.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's a magnificent but small river.
Yes.
That comes out of the coastal mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I think I say that's my favorite because that's now where I live. My favorite river often tends to be the one near where I am. When I came through this part of Illinois, my favorite river was the Sangamon. I went to Allerton Park. I had heard about back in the dam fighting days. Perhaps we could talk mm-hmm. about that in a minute. I was involved then, and people like John Marlin here and Bruce Hannon were active in that effort to save that river, and eventually I got to see it, and I was just blown away by the beauty of that amazing riparian corridor that still exists right there in the heart of Illinois, in the heart of Big Ag country. You go down to the Sangamon River there, and it's like going back to a natural paradise. You know, that was my favorite river, I think, at that time. The Salmon River of Idaho is really a favorite as well. You know, it's one of the longest, relatively undammed rivers in our country. It goes through mostly wild country. And it's probably my favorite simply because it is representative of what so many of our rivers once were before they were so affected. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we are about our midpoint here. Let me again introduce our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Tim Palmer. He is a writer, writes about environmental issues, rivers particularly. He is the author of 19 books that deal with rivers and conservation and the environment. He's also a photographer, has one of the most complete collection of photos of rivers in the U.S., and he's been doing this for a long time, has a degree in landscape architecture from Penn State and did work as a land use planner for a while and then decided what he really wanted to do was spend time outside, travel, write about that, take photos. He's done a lot of work in the area of river conservation, travels around the country, does a lot of speaking because he says that what he's really hoping to do with his writing and speaking and photography is to get people to think about the environment and to want to take care of it. He's here visiting in our area and will be the featured speaker for the 11th annual dinner of the Prairie Rivers Network, and that's going on tonight. You can certainly find his books, and one recent one that I've had the chance to look at is Rivers of America, and it's has a lot of really stunning photos in it. And then a new one, is that actually out?
Yes, David, it came out last month.
Okay. And that more focuses on a different kinds of things.
It's called Trees and Forests, Trees and Forests of America.
One thing I want to make sure that I give you a chance to talk about, and I know that you'd like to talk about, is the health of our rivers. So it seems that you'd have to say there actually has been progress if you go back to, say, even the late 1960s, that in a lot of ways things are better, but that maybe they're not what you or what any of us would really like them to be.
Yes, David, there is a lot to celebrate here. I grew up along the Ohio River downstream from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And my grandfather and I fished. All we ever caught were carp, and we didn't eat them. Today you can catch walleye there. You're still not supposed to eat very many of them, unfortunately. But that's one example. You know, to encapsulate this very, very big question, we've made remarkable progress in two areas. We've brought to a halt the big dam building era of America. We need dams for water supply and other purposes, but it had gone on way too long. Virtually all the feasible practical sites had been built on, yet the momentum to build had continued. There was a lot of controversy over unnecessary dam construction projects in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s. We've essentially brought that unnecessary dam construction to a halt. That's one area. The other area is the really egregious water quality problems of municipal sewage and traditional industrial waste. Thanks to the Clean Water Act of 1972, a landmark legislation that Congress for the last 8 years and the administration have been trying to undercut, but thanks to it, we now have rivers that you don't need to get typhoid shots, you know, if you end up falling in the water, which was the case when I rode on the crew on the Potomac River in Washington, D.C. in the 1960s. And so we've solved a lot of those problems. The really hard sewage problems have been cleaned up to a large degree. The traditional industrial waste we've gotten somewhat of a grip on. It's certainly not solved. But here's the bad news. Overall, water quality in America is still getting worse. Even though we have some spectacular improvements in high-profile rivers, such as the Chicago, the Ohio, and so forth, overall, the quality is still getting worse for two big reasons. One is the biggest polluter is agriculture. And agriculture is virtually unregulated by the Federal Clean Water Act, or by states, which typically do less to regulate water quality than the federal government. Polluted runoff, we call this. You know, it's the sheets of silt and pesticide-laden runoff that drain from our farmlands all across the country is still a big problem. We have made some headway there through what they call best management practices. These are voluntary guidelines on how you can farm better. It involves things like having buffer strips between the river and the fields, you know, by more conservative application of fertilizer and pesticides and herbicides, those kind of things. We've made some headway, but not really very much in the big picture. Agriculture is still the biggest polluter by far of rivers in America. We simply have not come to grips with that problem in the way that we need to do if we want healthy rivers and healthy water supplies for the future. The other big problem we have today is that where the old industrial wastes were these hideous chemicals that you could see and smell and killed the fish instantly, and you know, they were just dramatic problems. Today we have a whole epidemic of toxins that you neither see nor smell or are aware of unless highly sophisticated testing is done. Thousands of these are coming on the market each year, virtually untested. And so while we used to have wastes that were easy to spot, now we have an epidemic of toxins that are very difficult to identify and to control, but no less. In fact, they're more harmful than the old ones were.
We have another caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Someone in Mattoon on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to disagree with the with the guest today. He says that agriculture is a polluter. I think if he would do his homework, he would see that, yes, there are problems there, but nothing like we had in the past. And agriculture is working very hard to be good stewards of the land and be good farmers using best practices in conservation. And they're not using a tenth of the herbicides or chemicals they were even a decade ago. You cannot afford it, and you cannot... It just doesn't work properly, and they're using a tenth of what we were a decade ago and probably a 20th of 20 or 30 years ago. And if you look around, you'll see buffer strips and strips of grass along the rivers that they have voluntarily set aside, and sometimes they have paid to set aside. But regardless, it is the no-till practices they're using, and some of the crops they are planting, and they're leaving the fodder and the corn stalks and no-tilling into them and not tilling the soil. So, yes, there are problems, but I think the guest has to recognize that agriculture has came a long, long way, and there's other issues besides that the farmers get to blame for, like septic systems and those kind of things. Am I correct?
Thank you so much. I appreciate your comment. I do not disagree with you at all. We have made headway. You've identified some of these areas where it has happened, and I commend farmers who have done that. You know, my point was simply that agriculture remains the biggest single problem, and I think that's very evident from state and federal water quality information, you know, wherever it's taken. But your point is extremely well taken, and that is that headway has made, and those who have taken the effort to improve their operations and their farming practices deserve a lot of credit, and I would be the first one to want to give them that credit as well. So thank you very much.
It's just the vastness of it. I mean,
that's right. It's a huge problem, and we've come to grips with it, and we need to keep at it. So thank you for what you do.
Any one river would have thousands and thousands of acres that would eventually drain into it.
That's right. It's an enormous problem.
Great program.
All right. Well, thank you. I was expecting to hear from somebody like this just because I know we have a lot of people listening who are involved in agriculture, and I'm sure that they would say quite sincerely that they recognize this and that it's something that a lot of farmers are moving to try to – they're trying to improve the situation. And I think that they might say, and with fairness, that also various kinds of runoff from urban areas, stuff that runs off the streets, stuff that runs off of people's lawns, we have golf courses and things like that, do also contribute to the problem, because it all ends up sooner or later draining into our streams and rivers.
That's right. Absolutely.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, do you feel that in fact that federal legislation has indeed been positive here, and that particularly the clean water legislation has actually had a positive effect?
Oh, definitely, David. We certainly wouldn't be where we are without it. You know, it was a landmark legislation that passed in 1972, and it's been updated several times since. And without that guidance and authority, you know, and the money that came with it, frankly, back at that time, we wouldn't have made anywhere near the headway that we have. Unfortunately, the job is not done. You know, the Clean Water Act said that all the waters of America were to be fishable and swimmable by, guess the date, 1985. Okay. We aren't anywhere close to that even today. And, you know, for the two reasons I mentioned, as well as others, you know, there's plenty of other problems, as you say, that have slipped through the cracks as well. And but we wouldn't be anywhere near where we are without that legislation and the funding that went with it. The sad part is that for much of this time, certainly the last 8 years, there have been efforts to undercut the Clean Water Act. The Bush administration exempted small streams from the Clean Water Act. And Let's talk about mountaintop removal in a minute. If it is a small stream issue, the and other, you know, around the corners, wherever they could undercut the implementation of the act, they have. I mean, enforcement has been reduced across the board at the federal level and at most state levels. So the you know, the people causing the problem, it's very unfair because a lot of people do what they can to solve the problem. Others don't, and you know, they're not paying the price that they should pay in a legal society. So there are ways that that the Clean Water Act has been undercut and ignored and subverted, and we need to get back to the job of tackling this problem and seeing that those goals held up by the Clean Water Act in 1972 are in fact realized.
Yeah. You were talking about mountaintop removal. This is a thing, in, at least in certain regions of the country, is a big issue. Locally, people are very concerned about this technique that is being used to extract coal, where essentially what they're coming along and doing is literally blowing off the top of mountains and then just sorting through the wreckage, taking the coal out and just dumping what's left, mm-hmm. and that resulted in really serious problems for these water systems because they end up filling up with all of the leftovers.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you know, David, I grew up in strip mine country in southwestern Pennsylvania. Strip mining, I'm sure everybody knows about it. You strip away 20, 30 feet of soil, dig out a couple of feet of coal underneath that and cover it back over, plant grass or trees and call it good. That done properly, that can cause relatively few problems, but of course it was done improperly through most of history and the problems are enormous. What we see today, however, is many, many, many times worse than the worst of strip mining that we have ever seen. Mountaintop removal, they don't take 20 or 30 feet off, they take 600 or 800 feet, literally cutting the tops, the whole upper half of the mountains off in West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, Western Virginia. And what they do with all of that material is dump it in the stream valleys draining off of that mountain. They're literally filling up those valleys and hollows and canyons and with this material, which is waste, but unfortunately is called fill. And so that way they've gotten around the Clean Water Act, which would otherwise probably stop this from happening. It's one of the most egregious problems we have in the country now. I visited these sites on a recent tour I did of the Appalachian Mountains, and it's just appalling to see what local people have to put up with in what the big coal companies are doing here to mine in this way, which is unnecessary. And, you know, the other there are two particular problems. I talk about polluted runoff and old industrial waste and so forth, but the two things that really stand out today as particular problems to me across our country are mountaintop removal, and the other are large unregulated feedlots. And that's one that's a little closer to home here. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, 10,000 cow dairies, and you know, which isn't really agriculture, which of course means the culture of the soil. But, you know, this is industrial dairies, and the magnitude of problems caused by these for our water and our air and our communities are just beyond anything we imagined, you know, 10 and 20 years ago.
You, a little earlier, we were talking about the fact that there was a period where there were a lot of people, various places around the country, that were fighting efforts to build dams. And I wonder, now that so many people are talking about our energy needs and need for renewables, trying to get away from using fossil fuels, whether again there are going to be places where there are going to be people saying, well, we could build a hydroelectric plant here. We could use the energy of the river. We could use that to generate electricity, and that's good because it doesn't pollute and it doesn't mean we're going to buying oil from Saudi Arabia or whatever. Do you think going to be a return to that kind of fight? Because there will be people who will say, well, you know, we need the energy and this is one of the ways that we could meet it, and that's clean energy.
That argument certainly will be made, David. In fact, about between 8 and 12% of our energy now comes from hydropower. The engineers that located the dam sites and then designed and built them up through the 1960s really did their job well. They identified virtually all of the good hydropower sites that there were. And this happened before there were before there was a real strong movement to protect rivers. So basically, they built those hydro dams wherever they wanted to. We've pretty much exhausted the hydropower potential of America. There's some little projects here and there that might get a kilowatt or two, but the significant sites are all taken. So there's really not much more to be done with hydropower. Now, the one exception to that is where we have dams that are viable structures. A lot of them are unsafe, the old dams. But where we have a viable dam that is not producing hydropower, there may be some real opportunities to add hydropower facilities into it and increase a nominal energy supply that way. But the proposals we will see in the coming era of change in energy, the proposals we see for hydropower will essentially be for smaller projects that are not going to produce very much power, but they're going to end up threatening some of these very few remnants we have left of natural rivers supporting a diverse biology and native fish systems and valuable rivers all across our country.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Tim Palmer. He is an award-winning writer and photographer. He's the author of 19 books on rivers, conservation, and the environment. One of his recent books, Rivers of America, which is published by Abrams, a really beautiful book, got a lot of really nice photographs in there. A new one that's just out that's on trees and forests. So you can take a look for his books. You can go down to the bookstore. You can go down to the library. He is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. He's the guest speaker, the featured speaker for the 11th annual dinner of the Prairie Rivers Network. And we're pleased that he could be with us here and talk for a bit. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Someone next to talk with in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. The speaker has outlined many problems along our rivers. I wonder if he could give us a short list of actions that the ordinary citizen can take to restore and protect rivers.
Thank you so much. I actually just slipped a note to David saying, what can people do? So your call is just perfect. A number of things. Let's just kind of start from the small and work up. Become informed. Learn about your river and what its problems and what its values are. And there are ways of doing that. There are local planning programs. Here in an area like where we are today in Champaign, there are academic people who have studied rivers a lot. There are educators who know about these places. Learn about your river. Then teach others, especially children. One of the really sad things about our society today to me is that children are losing touch with nature. They simply are not getting out there. And so take a child out into nature and the natural world along a river and show them just how wonderful it is, because there's no substitute for that. Going beyond that, you can join an organization. There are a lot of them. It didn't take me too long in becoming involved with rivers until I realized it's not enough to understand a river, to love a river, and to become involved myself. In order to protect a place, you need an organization. There are a lot of those. There are watershed organizations. In Illinois, the Prairie Rivers Network is the statewide river conservation group. There are fishing groups. There are a lot of kinds of conservation groups active in efforts to protect and restore their waterways. Join them. They need you. They need your support. And you need their support, frankly, to tell you what to ask our politicians to do. That leads me to the next point, which is become politically involved. Democracy is not a spectator sport. And this point shows most in the treatment of our landscape and our environment. We simply have to be more politically involved. We've got to get better people elected to office. And once they are, we have to encourage them to do the right thing. And that means establishing a relationship with them. Call them up, send them letters, let them know that you care about your local place and about its health and vitality. So become politically involved. And at other levels in this question, you know, a really important thing to do is protect private lands along rivers. Landowners can do this. Farmers can do this. Land trusts and conservancies do this by buying some of the most critical open space along rivers. And there are a lot of land trusts in Illinois that do this, that purchase land from willing sellers to protect as open space. So if you own land, take good care of it. And support land conservancies and watershed councils and groups like that that try to encourage others to take care of their land. So those are a few things. I hope that helps.
Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. And again, we'll go to another caller. This is someone who is listening in Effingham on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks, David. A great show. I got in late, so maybe my question's already been addressed. Recently, I viewed a documentary from Eastern Illinois University, some young people and the professors put together about, and some of it was water. And during the program, they stated that there were 8,000 square miles dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, the confluence of the, or where the Mississippi empties into the Gulf, and a huge area. And I'm wondering if your guest has addressed that, or I'm sure he knows about it. But yeah. Is there anything to say about that?
Yeah, certainly. This is one of the just incredible phenomenons of our time. You know, our environmental problems have reached a scale that we never really imagined 20 years ago. For example, we didn't know about global warming and climate change, or acid rain, for that matter. The dead zone is another one of these things that is at this massive scale that we certainly couldn't comprehend back then. But there are so many nutrients and pollutants going down the Mississippi River, which drains 42% of America, that they're consuming the oxygen and polluting the water far out into the Gulf of Mexico, and killing fish life and other life as well. And this is all because of what we do to the land. And Illinois, frankly, is one of the big contributors to this problem. The whole Corn Belt is. And, you know, it has to do with the runoff off of our land that washes into the rivers, carrying nutrients and phosphates with it and other pollutants, goes down the river into the Gulf and causes these problems. We need to recognize that everything that we do to the land affects our waters. And those are the waters not only where we take our drinking water, but it's also the groundwater, because groundwater and surface water are certainly intimately connected here. It involves our larger rivers, you know, such as the Illinois and the Sangamon and the Mississippi. And it involves our estuaries and oceans as well. But We've simply got to recognize that everything we do to the land affects all of these. And the report card coming home from the Gulf of Mexico on what we're doing up here is not so good. So, that's one of the indicators that we still have a long way to go.
One other thing that I've learned recently is somewhere on the ocean, these folk described and showed a mock-up of an area the size of the U.S. That is filled with plastic waste, the bottles and bags and anything else that, you know, the plastic floats, and now there's somehow the configuration of and how that all moves is massing there. I can't remember which ocean it is. Would you know anything about that?
Yeah, I've actually heard it's the size of Texas, but you know, Texas is a pretty big place.
Yes, well,
and I'd say that's big enough.
Yeah, too.
And here again, this is just a great indicator that the Earth is a closed system. You know, this piece of trash you throw out, or maybe it's just the bag that you get at the grocery store that ends up blowing away in the wind someday. It ends up in a stream. It ends up in a river. It ends up in the Gulf. It ends up in the ocean. Finally, it ends up in this big eddy out in the South Pacific, the size of Texas. And, you know, what a sad symbol of our society, and what a great reminder that we simply have to take more responsibility for what we're doing.
It's an end to the entrails of birds and fish. And
that's right. That's right. It causes a lot of problems.
Yeah, like very that. Horrible. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Show day.
We have a couple of minutes left. I guess I would kind of like to return to just talking a little bit about the photos that are in Rivers of America. I would really like to suggest to people that they go and look for the book, because it has a lot of really beautiful images. I guess to me, what really impresses me most about a lot of these photographs is that they have movement in them. That you have obviously that's something else that you're attracted to and you're interested in trying to show, and it reminds me, I think, of attempts that other kinds of artists, various kind of painters, particularly, have tried to make to show water in movement. It particularly makes me think of very old Chinese landscape paintings, and the attempt to show water moving. And I'm just really, really struck by that. And you see it in picture after picture.
Thank you, David.
I'm interested in having you, you know, talk about that and how you do it, maybe.
Thank you. You really got it. You are the author's best friend here. One of my real goals as a photographer is not to simply show what nature is, but to show what it does. And so rivers are easy. They move, you know. But also I'm talking about the weather and fire and snow and light and all these things. So, you know, I don't really take a picture unless I think it has that aspect of showing what nature actually does. And the movement of rivers is, of course, just one of the truly magical things about them. They are the animated part of the landscape. They move, they change, they reflect color. And in that sense, they take on the color of everything around them. How amazing that is, really. We take it for granted, but just how amazing is that? And so in the book, what I really wanted to do, you know, I've talked a lot about the problems here. I discuss those in one chapter of the book. I don't really show the problems in the book. I elected instead to simply find the most beautiful scenes I could of rivers all over our country, because I want to fire people up about protecting nature and about reestablishing the ties that we always had to the natural world, ties that are essential if we're going to have a planet worth living on in the future. And so my book celebrates what remains. You know, in Illinois, I have a picture of the Middle Fork of the Vermilion River in here at sunrise. I canoed up the river, then I waded into the current. I sat down in the water with my camera about 2 inches above the flow to really capture this feeling of the Vermilion River as a living thing, which of course it is. And so I really tried to celebrate nature, to get people excited about it again, so that you might want to take your child back out there and see what's there and enjoy it and appreciate it. And in that way, reestablish the ties that we must have to the natural world and to our Earth all around us. Thank you so much.
Well, I guess Tim Palmer, he is author of many books that have to do with conservation and the environment, and particularly interested, as we have said, in rivers. So you might look for his book, Rivers of America. Abrams is the publisher, or a brand new book that has images of trees and forests. He is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. He's the guest speaker for the 11th Annual Dinner of the Prairie Rivers Network. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's great to be with you.
Support for the program comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. That's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and the host of the show is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with an award-winning health journalist who holds a PhD in health policy. His name is Robert Davis, and he is the author of The Healthy Skeptic, Cutting Through the Hype About Your Health. That's what we'll talk about this afternoon, following the news from NPR at 106. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat trading at 542 and a quarter, down 6. March, 557 and a quarter, down 5 and a quarter. In Chicago, December wheat trading at 503¾, down 8. March, 525, down 6. December corn, 353, down 10¾. March, 369¼, down 10¾. May, 380½, down 10½. July, 391½, down 10¼. January soybeans, 858½, that up 2½. March, 867, up 4¼. May, 876, up 4½.